Hi, it's Brendan here, and you are about to listen to my conversation with a fascinating Matt Ridley. I just wanted to let you know that we recorded this next door to a room that was pretty noisy, so there is some background noise, but don't worry, you can still hear the whole thing, and it's really worth listening to. Enjoy.
We're witnessing a gradual shift to something that looks much more like direct democracy. You know, this is the birth pains of direct democracy. You know, that representative democracy is fine, but we are going to have to get used to the fact that people want to express their view directly through these new technologies and things, and that a referendum is a genie out of the bottle and is not going back in.
Hello and welcome to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill. This is a podcast in which an esteemed guest joins me to talk about the big ideas, the bad ideas, the problems and the controversies of life in the early 21st century. In this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Matt Ridley. Matt is a businessman, a journalist, an author, and perhaps most famously and unusually, an optimist. Matt writes a weekly column for The Times, and he also contributes to The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of numerous books, including The Origins of Virtue, The Rational Optimist, and most recently, The Evolution of Everything. His books have sold more than a million copies, and they have some impressive fans. Mark Zuckerberg described The Rational Optimist as very important and powerful, while also saying that he had some major disagreements with it too. Matt is also a Viscount and a member of the House of Lords, which we might come on to shortly. Matt, welcome to the show.
Brendan, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Matt, I want to kick off by asking you about optimism and rational optimism and your very well-known book on this subject. And it does strike me that it's a pretty radical proposition to be optimistic in this day and age, because we do live in an age of pessimism, which is not new. Many ages have been ages of pessimism, most of them arguably. But today, the pessimism feels incredibly pronounced. It seems to cross the entire political spectrum. And it seems to have a genuinely detrimental impact, not only on how we view ourselves and the world, but also on our ability to pursue progress. So I wonder if you could start off by explaining why you remain optimistic at a time when so few people are.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a, you know, it's a loser. You know, if I turned pessimist overnight, I'd sell more copies of books, I think. I do think, on the one hand, nothing much has changed. Go back and look at previous periods in history, even when things were going great in the Victorian times, people were writing books saying, you know, it's all going to go horribly wrong. They had different problems they were dealing with then. But I call it turning pointitis, the idea that things have gone fine till now, but they're about to go horribly wrong. And that's true in every age. Everybody thinks that. But you're right, it's worse than usual now. It was pretty bad when I was growing up in the 1970s. The population explosion was unstoppable, famine was inevitable, the deserts were advancing, the rainforests were retreating. You know, all that stuff was really depressing to me as a teenager. And one of my motivations at the moment is to go around telling teenagers, don't worry, because the stuff you're hearing now is roughly what I heard in the 70s, and it turned out to be unbelievably wrong. I mean, genuinely, 180 degrees kind of wrong, because we have lived through the most extraordinary century, half century of human progress. We've taken global poverty down from 60 or 70% of the world living on less than $1.90 a day when I was born to less than 10% today doing that. No, that's never happened in human history before. We've got child mortality, the greatest measure of misery anybody can think of, down by two-thirds. We've got longevity, lifespan increasing at the rate of about 5 hours a day at the moment globally. That's an amazing thought when you think about it. So there are extraordinary trends going in the right direction. And we're not just wealthier and healthier, we're also happier, cleverer, cleaner, kinder, freer, more peaceful, more equal. I can give you data on all of those. More equal is the one that nobody thinks is true. Everybody thinks inequality is getting worse. It's not getting worse in this country. It's not getting much better, but that's because we have ridiculous tax and residential housing market that rewards the haves at the expense of the have-nots, and so we have to have a redistributive tax system to balance that. But globally, inequality is plummeting because people in poor countries are getting rich faster than people in rich countries. Just one example of that, Mozambique has more than doubled its GDP per capita since the Great Recession. Italy has moved nowhere since the Great Recession. So Mozambicans have caught up with Italians on average. And that's happening all around the world. Africa has had a remarkable decade, and people on the whole are not noticing that. You know, we're getting rid of wars, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, I could go on about this forever. And of course, the Hans Rosling experiment that he did when he asked people, do you think global poverty has doubled, halved, or stayed the same in the last 20 years, extreme poverty. And he got the answer that 65% of people in this country and in America think that it's doubled, whereas in fact it's halved. 5% think it's halved. So 5% are right and 65% are wrong. But he then points out that if he wrote those three answers on three bananas and threw them to a chimpanzee and asked which it picked up first, it would get the right answer 33% of the time. It would do six times as well as human beings at answering a question about human society, which goes to show just how far this insistence on pessimism has seeped into everybody's minds.
So those statistics are brilliant and fascinating. And so we can, anyone who kind of applies rational thought will see reasons to be optimistic for the reasons you've just given, among others too. But what underpins the culture of pessimism in your view? Because it's so widespread. It comes so naturally to both people on the right and the left, in fact, whether they are fear-mongering about some kind of bird flu taking over the world and killing all of us, or the heating of the planet, of course, which is a relentless panic that has been going on for many years now. Among the left, there is a particularly strong strain of doom-mongering where they think everything about capitalist society is just evil and bad and rotten. And they go trawling as much as possible for any statistic that will prove how awful human life is. I always thought that the redefinition of poverty, so that it now basically means very relative poverty, is one way through which they can then argue that huge numbers of Britons live in terrible poverty-like conditions. So there's that constant search for proof that human society is a pretty bad thing. So what drives that side of it? What drives the kind of clinging on to the pessimistic worldview?
There's a lot of things, but I think three are important. One is the media's insistence on reporting bad news and not good news. And the reason they do that is because we like bad news. We're more interested in bad news. Mm. people don't read good news. You can do the experiments. You can give them a chance to read good news, and they're just not interested. So if it bleeds, it leads, as they say in the newspaper business. Good news is no news, and all these kind of slogans. So there's that issue. The second thing is an evolutionary psychology thing, I think, that on the whole, bad news is more salient than good news. So it's probably a good idea to be more alert to bad things that might happen. You sound wiser. You know, Cassandra was wise. Pollyanna was a fool, you know. and the reason for this probably is because you and I were walking to the waterhole 500,000 years ago, and you said, I wouldn't go that way if I were you. I think there might be a lion behind that rock. And I say, no, everything's fine. The world's getting better and better. I'm dead, you're alive, and your genes are in the next generation via my girlfriend. But the third aspect of this, I think, is a sort of psychological thing that a guy called Daniel Gilbert at Harvard University has recently been talking about, which is called prevalence-induced concept creep. And what this means is that as things get rarer, so we redefine the concept so that they're not so rare. The simplest example is he shows people dots, colored dots, and he says, press a button whenever you see a blue dot. And to start with, they press buttons whenever they see a blue dot. But then he makes the blue dots rarer and rarer, and they start pressing the button when they see a purple dot.
Right.
And so you can see the analogy here. What's happening is that this another word for this phenomenon is the first world problem. 70 years ago, bad news meant 6 million people being gassed to death. Today, bad news is that you can't get a phone signal for 10 minutes on a train. I exaggerate, but you see the point. That,
yeah.
For example, yeah. Plane crashes are very, very much rarer than they were now. I mean, 2017 was actually a year in which no commercial jet airliner crashed. A passenger jet airliner is extraordinary. You know, wasn't true in 2018. But, you know, the numbers are unbelievable when you consider how many more people there are in the air than ever before. And as a result, a crashing jetliner gets far more coverage than it ever did before. Yeah. And people are just as scared of flying, sort of thing. So there's a sort of psychological adjustment. We it's as if we've got a fixed appetite for pessimism that has to be satisfied by something.
Yeah. In my case, I'm more scared of flying than I was in the past. So I kind of freak out whenever I read any of those stories. But that's absolutely true, where in some cases, the rarer something becomes, the more exotic it becomes in terms of the coverage and the headlines, and therefore it can kind of bleed into people's minds as this huge spectre that they should be concerned about. But I wonder if alongside the psychological disposition to worry or panic or to think about bad news in order to prepare yourself for life in general, there are also cultural and political turns that have taken place, so that the fabric of society itself becomes more open to panic and distress and doubt in human endeavor. I've always thought that the 1970s were probably quite an important turning point in relation to the current climate of pessimism. That's really when, you know, hardcore environmentalism takes hold, not only of activists, but also of political elites around the world. That's when the population panic comes back, having kind of reared its ugly head for decades before that too. So is there, alongside our psychological thirst for worry or for concern, there is something in the political social makeup of late 20th century, early 21st century Western society that kind of pushes this stuff further and further?
Well, I think the switch from television to social media as the main broadcasting, as the main sort of communication medium, will have had an effect in this respect. I mean, it's pretty commonplace now to see that social media has caused a great polarization, that we tend to become more extreme in our views and live in echo chambers and filter bubbles and things like that. And I think to some extent that has helped pessimists more than it's helped optimists.
Right.
Sure, it's allowed optimists like you and me to get to know each other and have a little group therapy every now and then about how much worse the world is getting in terms of people's pessimism. But it's also, I think, given a megaphone, an amplifier to a lot of this. So let me give you just a little example, and it comes onto the climate change story. In today's Times newspaper, reading it on the tube on the way here, there's a letter from a lot of professors saying we mustn't do fracking because of climate change. And it calls in aid a report by the Institute of Public Policy Research, a UK left-leaning think tank, which came out a couple of weeks ago, which said that, you know, flooding is up 15 times since 2005, and a lot of other stuff about disasters that are coming. And so this is sort of, you know, this report from this think tank, which got a huge pub play on the BBC, etc., has been, you know, used to amp up the worry about climate change. Now, what, you know, let's look at that report. 15 times increase in flooding since 2005? Certainly not. The IPCC says there hasn't been any increase since 2005. Oh, they said, terribly sorry, that was a typo. We meant to say since 1950. Okay, well, it's still bunk. There's still been no increase. Well, what's your source? There's a database of disasters. Well, this database doesn't start in 1950. It starts in the mid-1990s. And the later you go, the more disasters it includes, because the wider the definition, back to this point about prevalence-induced concept creep.
Yeah.
So it now has traffic accidents in it, which it didn't. So that's why it shows an increase. Right. So what we've got here is a piece of absolute scientific pseudo-junk that has been laundered through a think tank, through the BBC, into a letter from professors to the Times saying this factoid is a reason why we need to change policy. And that sort of thing is happening all the time. Mm. And the laundering of lies really worries me, because it's getting much easier to do, because nobody ever goes back and checks the original source and looks up. And the other example, and I've written about this in The Spectator, is the insect extinction story, which, you know, is based on a paper that did one simple thing. They sat down at a desk, called up a database, put in a three-word search, insect, decline, and survey, and out popped some papers saying, we've done a survey which shows an insect decline. And out didn't pop the papers that said, we've done a survey and found some insects increasing.
Yeah.
So it's a completely biased sample. And yet that study, again, was everybody now thinks that insects are going extinct in the next 20 years, you know, based on one fib. And it is a fib. It's a wholly fraudulent use of scientific time, in my view. I'm allowed to say that.
Absolutely, you're allowed to say that. And I completely agree with you. And in fact, it touches on a question I wanted to raise with you, which is moving on specifically to the environmentalist issue, on which you and I have many agreements. One of the things that strikes me, and you've written about this and spoken about this, is how wrong they have been consistently over the past 50 or 60 years. You know, going right back to Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and which gave rise to this idea that pesticides would kill animals and have a terrible impact on human society, through to the panic about population and acid rain. And the big thing when I was a kid was the ozone layer. You don't really hear that much about the ozone layer anymore, but it's all we ever talked about at school.
Yeah.
And then, of course, climate change, which is related to the ozone layer and all that stuff. And in each case, the big, terrible, awful calamity that was predicted fails to materialize. It looks to me like it's an outlook. It's a moral outlook in search of a justification. So it can flip between these different panics because there's an already pre-existing propensity to believe the worst of humankind and of progress and of human endeavor and everything else. But why is it so immune to proof that it is wrong? How can environmentalism stagger on regardless of the fact that people like you and others have exposed that its biggest claims just don't stack up?
It's a really good question. And, you know, the answer is because it's got some kind of heat shield that off which rational arguments bounce in a very frustrating way. And people like Rory Sutherland, who writes about, you know, advertising, know this, that, you know, you don't win with rational arguments. They're necessary, but they're not sufficient. You need to the sizzle as well as the sausage. You know, you need to somehow sort of get through these points. And, you know, just to take the case of acid rain, which was a very formative issue for me because I was science editor of The Economist when it blew up and became a big issue in the early 80s. And I was covering it day to day, and I started out very alarmed because I rang up scientists and they said we should be very alarmed. And then I started reading deeper into it, and I started, you know, finding that actually, hang on a minute, you know, this is a bit exaggerated. You've just written a paper in which you say that 8% of the needles might have fallen off the spruce trees in one forest in 1 year, and you're saying this is a calamity coming? You know, I don't understand. And oh, well, you see, you have to understand that, you know, da, da, da. And so I began to get more skeptical about this. But acid rain came and went. And in the public's mind, what solved acid, what the reason it's gone away is because we solved the problem. We stopped producing sulfur dioxide from coal-fired power stations. But in fact, we now know there was no problem. Mm-hmm. There was a small degree of acidification of waterways, but the forest problem, the idea that forests were dying, let alone from acidification, turned out to be complete bunk. It was a pseudo-scientific story. Now, we know that because there was a $500 million study in the United States called the National Acid Precipitation Assessment Project, which reported just too late after the Clean Air Act had passed. So nobody was interested. And it said, actually, there is no forest death problem. There are local forest die-offs, and local pollution can kill. But the idea that somehow increased acidity and rain is causing forests to disappear in Western Europe, which is what people were saying, turns out to be not true. So you've got the other problem here, that the lie is halfway around the world before the truth has got its boots on. Mark Twain didn't say that.
Yeah, someone did.
Jonathan Swift said something similar, but you know, it's a great quote. Whoever said it.
You used an interesting word there when you talked about your thinking process during the acid rain story. You said you were skeptical, which is one of my favorite words. I think it's great to be skeptical, but of course there are people out there who would call you a denier. which is a bad thing to be. And one thing I wanted to ask you about was, you've in relation to climate change, which is the kind of contemporary manifestation of all these kind of environmentalist fears that have grown up over the past few decades, you described yourself as a lukewarmer. So yep. You're not a climate change denier. You accept that there is an impact from human behavior on climate. But one of the worst aspects of the ideology of environmentalism is its intolerance of questioning. So you would be written off, no doubt, as a denier. So do you think part of that kind of, you say there's a heat shield which bounces off rational criticism, but there's also a kind of moral force field which protects it from any kind of public questioning at all, really? Do you think that's partly driven by a recognition on their part that their claims might not stack up, or is there just a kind of moral certitude and arrogance about the kind of green crusade that they are pursuing?
It's very interesting, isn't it? I do wonder about some of the people who you really do exaggerate this kind of stuff, you know, from Al Gore onwards, whether or not in the dark of the night they think, oh God, you know, I can't believe I'm getting away with this, or whether they actually genuinely believe. And I think it's actually hard to underestimate the degree to which humans will self-deceive into believing themselves, as it were. So I wouldn't think that the big part of this is deliberate deception. I think it's you know, they genuinely think that the world is coming to an end tomorrow. But there is a coming together here of two things: the psychological appeal of millenarianal doom, which is being exploited by people to make money. You know, and let's not forget, this is very profitable. You know, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, and World Wildlife Fund, the three big green multinationals, because they are multinational businesses with, you know, chief executives on huge salaries and bonuses and all, you know, all the usual multinational stuff and people flying around the world all the time. They have a annual income between them of something like $1 billion. I mean, this is gigantic money. And unlike Coca-Cola, they don't have to spend that money on making a product. Mm-hmm. All they have to do is spend that money on making more money. i.e. getting out there and getting their message out there. So, you know, to take another example, the attack on glyphosate weed killer is driven by a legal industry that is after a payout from juries for people who've died of cancer, like the lawyers got from tobacco. I mean, you know, the billions of dollars that lawyers got from tobacco, everybody's trying to achieve the next one.
Yeah.
And they think the next one is glyphosate herbicide. So they are frantically trying to launder bad studies into evidence that will convince juries. So there's a lot of, you know, they accuse me, because I do have an interest in fossil fuels. I come from a long line of coal mining people in the Northeast, and I actually have open cast coal mining on my own land still, which is unusual, and pretty well the last person to have that. It's not going to last very much longer. But so they accuse me of being hugely biased by that. I don't think I am particularly. I try and bend over backwards to talk about gas, which is coal's main competitor, actually. But nonetheless, if I am to concede that, then they should concede that there is big green is big money too. And the wind industry is now a very big funder of all sorts of activist stuff out there in the public sphere. So you have this is what Bruce Yandel, an American economist, called the Bootleggers and Baptists Coalition. What drove prohibition in the United States was, on the one hand, Baptist preachers saying thou shalt not drink, and on the other hand, bootleggers saying, yeah, and that'll make our profits greater.
yeah.
And so often in these things you get people who are actually have a financial stake in the game and people who are morally motivated, and they both get, well, the moral people get very cross if you accuse them of being financially motivated, but actually they're helping each other.
Yeah, I think that point about self-deception is very true, because it strikes me that you can understand why it would be so attractive to become a green zealot, because it would give you a sense of purpose and a sense of mission. And, you know, not only are you an ordinary citizen possibly engaged in politics and public life, but you're someone who's actively saving the planet and saving the world. And they use these incredibly grand terms, which I think probably means that they become less and less open to the possibility that the things they say are wrong, that the things they say are possibly misanthropic, that the science doesn't quite stack up. So it kind of all adds up to a kind of quite closed off form of activism. But
disappointment is the degree to which the profession of science has gone along with it. I mean, I'm a huge fan of science. I've been a defender, a proponent, a champion of science all my life in my writings. You know, I think science is the greatest human achievement, bar none. Mm-hmm. You know, our understanding of deep geological time, of evolution, of the idea of DNA, of the scope of the universe, you know, these are cultural prizes second to nothing that we've achieved, and it's incredible that we've managed to do them through this process of experiment and hypothesis and all this kind of thing. And to have that profession turn into a sort of preaching, don't challenge, get in line, follow a consensus, don't talk about how climate works, just talk about what we must do politically, is so disappointing to me. You know, I still love science as a philosophy, but I'm increasingly disaffected from it as an institution.
That was actually going to be my next question, was in relation to what this has done to science. And I wonder where you think the balance lies in relation to this, because I sometimes struggle with thinking that the scientists are the bad guys for going along with this stuff so willingly, because suddenly they're no longer just men in laboratories doing experiments, which we agree is a very important thing to do, but they are public figures. They're engaged in this kind of end of the world battle and so on. So part of me thinks the scientists are a problem because they've bought into this self-flattering narrative. But then also I think environmentalist activists have completely bastardized science and utilized it and exploited it in a way that is very anti-science. So if you look at their phrase, the science, I mean, there in recent years, there have been people actually marching with banners and placards which say, listen to the science. They always say the, as if it's this kind of decree from on high, which you can't possibly ignore.
But when you think what science went through to stop people talking about the truth,
that's
God and all that, you know, is incredible. And I think that you have to get your head around what confirmation bias is here, because we're all guilty of confirmation bias. We get an idea, we look for evidence that supports it, we don't look for evidence that challenges it, and we champion the idea, like a lawyer in court championing his client. I do that, you do that, etc. We're doing it now. But what keeps us honest is that somebody else challenges us by championing the opposite idea. And that's how science has always worked. Geographically, science has always been very scattered. You know, it's always in universities all over the place. It's not in any one place. And I think that has helped it stay honest, because Professor X says, I believe in evolution by natural selection, and I think this is the right way, and I'm going to write a book called The Origin of Species with 56 examples of how I'm right. And somebody else says, no, you're wrong, and he challenges it. And in this case, he's right, actually. You know, Darwin was right, in my view. but the point is, you don't say, I believe in evolution. That is now the scientific consensus. No one else must challenge it. You must all fall in line. That way, you wouldn't get it, wouldn't keep Darwin honest. You know, it has to be that you do these this challenge of ideas. So you pit one person's confirmation bias against another person's confirmation bias. And that's why in the climate change debate, this phrase, the consensus, is so dangerous and so misleading, because it's essentially saying you must not challenge. And it's also mad, because the consensus is a range from harmless to harmful. You know, I mean, nobody ever pretends that the IPCC produces a one number for how hot it's going to get by 2100. They produce 1 to 1.5 to 4 degrees, which is 1.5 is nothing and no problem. 4 degrees is terrible and quite dangerous. And nobody knows how probabilistic any outcome within that range is. So how can that be a consensus? It's not a consensus. Absolutely. It's a range.
But absolutely right that the when it becomes harder and harder and effectively a speech crime to challenge scientific claims or any kind of claim, in fact, then public discussion, public understanding just gets incredibly dumbed down because there's no possibility of falsifiability or disproving or keeping the person who's making the claim on his toes, making him prove it better and better all the time. That has completely been swept aside in relation to the science discussion on environmentalism. And that's a lesson across the board, I think, in public. I mean, even the Vatican had devil's advocates who would come in and purposefully say the opposite thing.
Did they?
In order to... you know,
that's where the phrase comes from.
Yeah, that's it? No, and it would allow you to deepen your understanding of the truth and to articulate it better. So I think that's a useful lesson for everyone to take on board. But one thing in relation to that that I wanted to ask you about was the broader problem of scientism, which goes even beyond the environmentalist question. And it does seem often that a political class which no longer feels that it has, I don't know, the democratic or moral authority to make certain claims or to pursue certain policies, does increasingly fall back on scientific authority. Now, raising this can be quite a controversial endeavor because people will say you're anti-science or anti-evidence and so on. But I do sometimes worry that the more that scientific claims are deployed in the political realm, then it's possible that both sides of that equation are harmed by that. So science becomes further and further exploited and possibly polluted as a consequence. And politics becomes less and less democratic because it relies on expertise over ordinary people's views. So do you see the problem of scientism? Well, do you think there's a problem of scientism? And do you think it goes broader than the environmentalist question?
Yes, I do. And I think this is what Michael Gove was getting at in his infamous remark about experts, although he was actually very, very specific. He was talking about experts from three-letter acronymed international organizations, but IMF and so on. And they deserved a kicking because they have got economic forecasts horribly wrong most of the time. And I actually think that the way around this is to say, look, we can agree on scientific truths about existing things, you know, that the world is spherical. I was going to say round, but that's wrong, isn't it? that the world is spherical, that the sun will arrive in the east tomorrow morning or whatever, you know. What we can't agree on is forecasts of the future in chaotic systems like the economy or like the climate. It is nonsense to try and say that we can be as certain about the future, that we can be as expert about the future as we are about the past. And, you know, the startling discovery in all this is Philip Tetlock's discovery that if you ask people to predict something, the more expert they are, the more likely they are to be wrong. Taxi drivers are better than economists at forecasting the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's unbelievably true. next week or something, but 10 years from now or whatever. That's telling you something, that too much expertise sort of gets in the way. And there is a reverence for scientific expertise that is sometimes misplaced. And that's partly because people don't do their homework. You know, they don't say, scientists say insects are dying out. They don't go and read the paper and find that actually that's based on a biased desktop survey of a database that means nothing. You know, people are so frightened of science and think they don't understand it that they don't ever look up the methods section, as it were, and get behind how a forecast was made and find out just how, you know, there is a big difference between study A, which says we found this and we based it on randomized controlled trials in very large samples and it's unambiguously true and we've challenged it and it was double blind and all this sort of stuff, versus somebody else who's just gone and looked something up and got a very small sample and left out the bits he didn't like and come up with a conclusion. They're both called scientists and they're both produced scientific papers, and one is nonsense and the other is not. And people, the problem with scientism is people not distinguishing between the two.
I want to come back to the question of expertise in relation to Brexit shortly. But one thing I wanted to ask you about, just to stick with the environmentalist theme for a second, is one of the sides of it that I find most dispiriting is the population panic. Because that strikes me as a very good example of pretty much everything that's wrong with the green outlook, because firstly, the population panic has been disproven so many times, going right back to Malthus, you know, famously predicting that we wouldn't be able to feed all the people on the planet. Obviously, he couldn't possibly predict the Industrial Revolution, the fact that we radically transformed how we organize society, how we transport stuff, how we trade, and so on. So he was completely wrong, you know, right through to population scaremongers who didn't predict the Green Revolution and the radical transformations that have taken place over the past few decades in relation to food production and food distribution. But it's still there. There is still this idea, particularly among kind of the NGO types, and left-wing doom-mongers are pretty big on this at the moment, that there are too many people being born, too many black babies, as they used to more honestly say in the past. What is it about, do you think, about the population issue in particular, which seems to draw out some of the kind of more explicit prejudices, if you like, in the green movement?
Curiously, I think that it's just as much a right-wing problem, this, right, as a left-wing problem, in as much as I quite often meet people who say, I actually agree with you on climate change. I think we're exaggerating the problem. But you've got to admit, the population is the real worry, isn't it? And to the extent that left-wing people are worried about population, it's often because of its impact on climate, by the,
yes,
way, you know,
yeah,
et cetera. And yes, it just keeps on coming round. The idea that everybody thinks population explosion is speeding up. It's not. It's slowing down.
Yeah.
The rate of increase of global population peaked in the 1960s and has been falling. It's halved since then. It was 2% a year then. It's now 1% a year, and falling fast. The absolute number of people added to the world population every year peaked in the 1980s and is now going down. Most countries are now near or even below replacement fertility of 2.1, which means that as the babies are born today mature, population is going to be falling in those countries. Bangladesh is at 2.1 at the moment. Iran is 1.6, right, or something. You know, these unbelievably low birth rates now all over the world. And where they are high, they're coming down fast. So places like Nigeria, it's halved in the last 15, 20 years, the birth rate. So so we are clearly heading for a very much slowing down population explosion that will lead to a stable or falling population in the second half of this century. Now, the UN produces a forecast which it was kind of nudged by activists into pushing up to 11 billion people by the end of the century rather than 9, which is what they were originally looking at. But to do that, they've slipped in some assumptions that we will speed up the rate at which we have babies again. Well, we might, but there's no evidence for that. I mean, everybody thought that as countries hit 2 children per woman, they would stop decreasing their birth rate. But they don't. They just plunge straight on through, down into the ones. You know, Italy, Japan, you know, these countries have way less than 2 children per woman at the moment in terms of total fertility in lifetime. It doesn't go away. And it is a very nasty area, because the history of it shows some real misanthropy going on here. A lot of it drove a lot of the eugenics, and it continued to drive eugenic arguments into the 1950s, despite what happened in the Second World War. You find people in the 1950s in the US, in the UK, saying we have to get population under control, because the real worry is that rich, clever people are having too few children, and
yeah,
poor, stupid people are having too many children. So we've got to sterilize people, and we've got to go out there. I mean, if necessary, we've got to do it by force. I mean, you know, Paul Ehrlich, the great saint of the environmental thing, says, yes, coercion will be necessary. And it was done. You know, let's not forget, coercion was done. You know, in India, basically the Americans said, you can't have any more aid until you do something about your population. And that means coercion. And so they rounded people up and sterilized them against their will. Lots and lots of people in the 1960s, in order to free up food aid from the United States. That's a pretty tacky story, and it's pretty disgraceful. And then in China, you get Mao wasn't too bad on this. He was ghastly on everything else. But funnily enough, he wasn't particularly worked up about this. It was Deng Xiaoping who said, we must have one-child policy. And, you know, everyone thinks that one child policy, well, you know, that's the one that's quite sensible. You've got to get the numbers down. Actually, the way that policy was enforced by the military, you know, was that if you had two children, not only you, but your village was punished. You know, I mean, there was, you were locked up, you know, you were, the children were forcibly removed. You know, there was real cruelty involved in imposing that policy. And everybody thinks that the only way to get things down is to sort of force people to change their habits. Whereas actually, countries that did very little, like Sri Lanka, say, had very little in the way of policies on this, saw their population growth rate figures fall just as fast.
Yeah.
Because what is it that stops women having lots of babies? Number one, that the babies stop dying. As soon as babies stop dying, women start planning smaller families.
Mm.
They say, well, I'm not going to go on having babies. I'm going to have two because I want two or three. Number two, they move to cities. And if you move to a city, children are a cost, not a benefit. You know, they're not working in your fields. They're actually, you have to get them educated and things. So people, again, plan smaller families. So people voluntarily and without pressure would have reduced families anyway. So a lot of the policies adopted in the name of population control have actually been completely unnecessary and very cruel. That said, you know, we do have to admit that 7 billion is a lot of people, and 9 billion will be even more, and feeding them is a challenge.
Yeah.
But we're feeding them better and better.
Yeah.
We're using less land to feed more people. We use 68% less land to produce the same amount of food as we did 60 years ago. That's an unbelievable improvement because of better seeds, better fertilizers, better mechanization, you know, fewer oxen, more tractors, you know, fossil fuels, all these kind of things.
Mm.
So I foresee that around 2050, if I live that long, I'll be 92 in 2050, population will probably have just about stabilized at that
right.
point. It'll be somewhere between 8.5 and 9.5 billion people. The amount of land we need to feed it will have shrunk pretty dramatically. We'll be doing a lot more indoor farming with hydroponics and all that sort of thing. So we'll have much bigger nature reserves. It'll be a pretty great time to be alive. We'll have brought back some extinct species, the great auk, the dodo, the mammoth, you know, genetics is going to do that in the next 20, 30 years. I'm actively looking at that myself. I'd like to be the first person to achieve it, but I don't think it's likely. But, you know, the technologies of gene editing is now in place
yeah.
where you can imagine that happening, etc. So I think it's going to be a pretty wonderful time to be alive. Now, we will face other problems, which is that we'll all be old, we'll all be grumpy, we'll all be anti-innovation, and there's nobody to look after us in our old age and all that kind of thing. But there's robots to do that, and so maybe that'll be all right.
Yeah, and they are practical problems that have practical solutions.
Exactly.
But I think that the reason I think the population issue is so important, in fact, even now, is because it really does expose the underpinnings of the age of pessimism, because what we have here is a very clear case where they tend to see population as the key variable and a terrifying variable, something that will shoot up in this kind of uncontrollable way. And they see everything else as being pretty much fixed. You know, human imagination, yep. human endeavor, the way we trade, the way we produce things, and the amount of land we need for farming. So it's that kind of, it shows the folly of pessimism, because if you have so little
yeah.
faith in the human capability and so much panic about human growth, you're
right.
just going to get things wrong and become a misanthrope.
Julian Simon once said, why is the birth of a calf or a lamb a good thing, the birth of a baby a bad thing?
Yeah.
How can that be true?
yeah.
You're listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. If you like this podcast and Spike's other podcasts, and also the articles and essays that Spiked publishes every day, please think about giving us a donation. Spike's content is free, and we want to keep it free, and donations really help us to do that. Head over to Spike's donation page now at www.spiked-online.com.
Okay, so I like the sound of your future, in which there'll be 8.5 billion people, there'll be dodos, there'll be great auks, maybe woolly mammoths, who knows. But one question I have in relation to your future, moving on to the next issue, will we still be in the European Union, or will we have left by that stage when you're 92 years old?
Oh, goodness. It doesn't feel like it, does it? I mean, we're within touching distance of this goal, which we voted for nearly 3 years ago. And we've got everybody trying to think of ways of stopping us getting there. And that's very, very frustrating for people. And I've sensed the frustration. I mean, I live in the north of England. You know, most people around where I live voted to leave. And whether they were Remainers or not, they come up to me and say, everything that Juncker and his chums have done since then have persuaded me that I should have voted leave, they say, if they were Remainers. Not all of them, obviously, but, you know, a lot of people say that. Can we not just get on with it? In the long history of predicting doom that doesn't happen, the doom that is going to happen when we leave without a deal is probably another one of these. It's the millennium bug. I mean, the millennium bug, it was extraordinary when you think about it, the Y2K phenomenon. People don't remember, but there were genuine forecasts of utter social breakdown. The National Guard was going to have to be on the streets of the United States, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing was going to work. Aeroplanes were going to drop out of the sky. And this stuff went on for year after year after year. And a lot of people made a lot of money going into companies and as IT consultants and saying, hey, I've checked it, your system's going to be fine. Now, obviously, it would be rash of me to say that nothing will go wrong if we leave without a deal. But we've had doom after doom punctured and debunked already for this. You know, the ports were going to seize up. Well, Calais said, no, that's not going to happen. Actually, in case of Dover, you know, there were huge queues in Kent in 2015 because Calais was blockaded by French fishermen. Did we see just-in-time manufacturing plants collapse? Did we see no food on the shelves? No. For several weeks, we had problems with that. We got through it. We would get through this. Likewise, you know, airplanes won't be able to land, data won't be able to transfer, food will disappear from the shops, et cetera, et cetera. We won't have any medicines. We won't have any clean water was one of the scares. Yeah. So scare after scare is coming around at the moment and being wrong. That doesn't mean that nothing will go wrong, of course. There's bound to be something that goes wrong, but I'm 90% sure that it will be quite a lot less than most people are saying. And I'm also 90% sure that the certainty that will then follow the next day will be an enormous fillip to business. You know, a lot of businesses are postponing decisions till they know what's going to happen. The transition period is not going to give us much certainty. Leaving without a deal would give us certainty. If it's certainty you want, let's get on with it. However, I have to admit that the chances of me seeing that day and being proved right about this are pretty small because there is no majority in Parliament for a clean break with the European Union. And parliamentarians are defying the will of the British people in a very dangerous way. People sometimes say to me, I'm being ridiculously sanguine about these threats of no deal, and how dare I be so callous, because what about the poor people who might lose their jobs or might not get enough food? And I say, well, I think you're being a bit callous about what might happen politically and socially if we defy the will of 17.4 million people and play into the hands of the likes of Tommy Robinson and other people like that. We will see probably a resurgence of loyalist violence in Ulster. We will probably see, you know, if Brexit is cancelled or delayed for a very long time, we will see a very unpleasant political situation. I think people will start disobeying the law in all sorts of ways. People will be very, very angry. That is not, I don't want to exaggerate that risk, but it is not a zero risk any more than the other one is a zero risk.
Absolutely. I think the pessimism and fear-mongering around, you know, the possibility of a no-deal Brexit, or increasingly around any kind of Brexit, which is faithful to the one that people voted for, has been extraordinary. And it is very similar to the kind of millennium bug panic, but I guess the difference, as you have written about and I've written about too, is that the target of this outburst of pessimism is not simply technology and whether it's up to scratch and so on, but it's basically the people and the electorate and the great, terrible apparently racist decision they made in June 2016. So I think one of the...
Well, I am stunned by the degree, you've written about this very eloquently, the degree to which it has come out what a lot of the elite thinks about a lot of ordinary people in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a member of the elite, you know, I'm a blooming hereditary lord and all that nonsense. But I have quite a lot of respect for the wisdom of crowds,
yeah,
for what ordinary people see, for this business that they often know just as well, certainly about their own lives, but also about the world generally, as ordinary people. I mean, as non-ordinary people, if you like. And I'm amazed by people saying that it was all motivated by racism, or that people didn't know what they were voting for. I mean, you know, I canvassed for Vote Leave, and I remember meeting people with, you know, Rottweilers and shaven heads and earrings in the wrong end of Gateshead, who, when I asked why they were voting Leave, gave me a word-perfect description of the democratic deficit and the need for better sovereignty and accountability. You know, we had a big argument for several months about this. We became experts on trade and all sorts of things which we weren't experts on before. We didn't learn every last fact, and we can't know the future. But the idea that there's something disgraceful or contemptible about ordinary people wanting to leave this top-down, imperialist, centralized, bureaucratic system run by some utterly unaccountable people, you know, who just appointed Martin Selmayr to whatever it is, Director General of the European Commission, in a way that the EU's ombudsman itself said was utterly irregular and should never have happened. And where's the accountability in that kind of, that's what people are really cross about, I think.
Absolutely.
And right to be.
They are right to be. And the more that this drags on, and the more that the EU treats us in the way it's been treating us, and the more that our most sections of our political class kowtow to that treatment, I think has only proven to people that they were right to have made that decision in the first place, to bring about a break and to bring about something new in politics. But one of the things... You mentioned the wisdom of crowds. I've always also been a fan of the wisdom of crowds, and the likelihood, in my experience, that a group of ordinary people will come to just as good a conclusion about the future of society as a group of Oxford-educated experts. But it does. It's interesting you use that phrase, because it does feel like what we're currently experiencing is not simply a political class which is reluctant to end our membership with the EU, but almost an unraveling of some of the claims of the democratic era itself. I thought it was very striking last year with all these kind of celebrations of the suffragettes and the first time that women got the right to vote 100 years ago, at the same time as the same people who were celebrating that were calling into question the 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit, which includes 8 million women. You know, who cares about those women? They're stupid and racist. It's only the kind of nice women who are friends in parliamentary circles who we really care about. So you have that, you had that dual process, and it just made their celebrations of the suffragettes sound so hollow, because they now spend the rest of their time calling into question the wisdom of asking ordinary people to make big political decisions. So do you think we're witnessing at least the exposure of the hollowness of the elite's commitment to the idea of democracy?
I'd put it slightly differently. I would say that we're witnessing a gradual shift to something that looks much more like direct democracy. Douglas Carswell is very interesting on this, and he argues that, you know, this is the birth pains of direct democracy. You know, that representative democracy is fine, but and it will persist for quite a long time. I'm not saying we ever get rid of it, but that you know, that we are going to have to get used to the fact that people want to express their view directly through these new technologies and things, and that a referendum is a genie out of the bottle and is not going back in. I'm not saying we're going to have one every 5 weeks or whatever, but the idea that you elect someone, send him off to Westminster and have him take decisions on your behalf without keeping him on some sort of a leash and keeping him to his promises, which is a, you know, sort of the way Churchill and people like that operated for a long time, is, I think, dying.
Yeah.
And I think in that sense, I just come back to this phrase, the genie's out of the bottle, because I think, I'm not saying the referendum has made referendums inevitable, but it has made, you know, you're not going to be able to go back to a world of Cameron and Blair and so on, where people will, on the whole, take it and do what they're told.
Yeah.
It feels like a different era, that. Now, that's pretty rich coming from a member of an unelected House of Parliament. but my excuse there is that, lords have extraordinary little power, really. You know, we can delay and amend legislation in little ways, and I try not to. That's not what I'm trying to achieve there. What I try and achieve there is, you know, is sitting on select committees and doing inquiries and sort of opening up issues and talking about issues rather than trying to change the world particularly. But, you know, if you came up tomorrow with a plan that we could all agree on for getting rid of the House of Lords and replacing it with something much more legitimate, but that is still a protector of the Constitution against a despotic majority in the Commons, then I'd be absolutely for it, and I'd fall on my sword immediately. And, you know, after all, the hereditaries are only there because the reform that was brought in 1999 effectively made it just one big, huge patronage system, which is even more dangerous in some ways. And we were left there as a sort of tiny guardian of a little bit of randomness in the system, if you like. And I've always thought that the one way to choose a second chamber might be to stick a pin in the phone book and say, for 5 years, you're a lord. Off you go and do a long version of jury service.
Yeah.
My colleagues, as you imagine, are completely horrified by that suggestion, because goodness knows who might turn up.
That sounds like a great idea to me. But it's, I agree with you about the reforms. I've always thought that I would prefer kind of very old hereditary peers nodding off than these kind of very active, you know, great and the good who've been brought in, who feel they must assert their power against the Commons. But I think you're absolutely right. That's a very interesting point you make about representative democracy and the possibility that we're moving on from that. One thing I find very striking, a lot of our MPs at the moment claim to be defending representative democracy, but through their behavior, they're signaling to people that there are severe limitations to representative democracy. And people are now thinking, well, if I elect you and then you go off and do whatever you like, including denying me the thing I voted for, then maybe representative democracy is more broken than I thought. So I think MPs are on a hiding to nothing in relation to that.
I think the three who've left the Conservative Party, having absolutely sworn blind to implement a 2017 manifesto and indeed to not stand in the way of Brexit, you know, Heidi Allen was very explicit on this, have a real problem, actually. I mean, you know, it's not as if this was a promise they made 5 years ago. It was a year and a half ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to touch on something which kind of draws these two themes together, that we started off with the whole environmentalist question, now we're on to Brexit. But one thing that I think binds these two things together. Firstly, there's the pessimism aspect, of course, of the elite response to these issues. But then there's the question of expertise. And you mentioned earlier Michael Gove and his criticism of experts, and everyone always forgets his follow-up line because he got interrupted during that TV discussion, and he was talking about financial institutions who've made numerous mistakes in their predictions, particularly in relation to economic issues. But I find that I think the kind of invasion of expertise into the political sphere is a problem. I mean, I love experts when it comes to fixing my iPhone or if I need an operation. You don't want the man in the street to give you an operation. You really need someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, but I don't want them building bridges.
You don't want them building bridges, don't we? Or, you know, firing rockets to the moon or whatever else it might be. So expertise has an incredibly important role to play in a modern society. Yeah. But when it comes to political decision-making, that's where expertise becomes a problem, because it explicitly disavows the idea that everyone has a voice in the political sphere, that everyone should be able to express their opinion and make their mark. So I wonder if the invasion of the experts into political decision-making, or the suggestion that they should play a key role, is really a modern form of the kind of philosopher kings, or, you know, back in the days when kings and queens really did rule the roost. That's kind of coming back, but in the PC guise of, you know, let's listen to the experts.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And we have got a surprisingly oligopolistic system, particularly when you look at the quangocratic state, you know, all these quangos that tell us what to do and tell us what we should eat for breakfast and so on, and which are appointed and are not that accountable. I'm sure they have to appear before Parliament every now and then, and they're appointed by ministers and things like that. But actually, when you look at, you know, who's most important in taking decisions in the countryside, is it your local MP or is it or councillor, or is it the official from the Environment Agency or Natural England or the Forestry Commission, or, you know, or one of these quangos? You know, they're unbelievably powerful, these, yeah. and much more so than they were 10 or 20 years ago. And they are allegedly experts and therefore unchallengeable, and they're civil servants, so we're not supposed to criticise them for some reason, so on. So I think that is an issue. But the idea that it's a return to philosopher kings is one I hadn't thought of, and I quite like that idea. At its worst, you know, the aristocratic system said, don't worry, your little heads, people, we've got this, we're in control, we know what to do. And so did kings with their courts, as it were. And they were often in court. You either had one or the other. And the difference was merely that the sort of aristocrat, you know, the barons versus the king, you know, the barons at least were geographically diverse,
yeah.
whereas the king's court was sort of all from the centre. So I see this partly as a centre-periphery issue as well, and I'm influenced there in the fact that I come from the northeast, a long way from London, where, you know, we regard London as a source of all idiocies, as well as a great place, you know. I mean, we're not all negative about it. And sorry, this comes back to the European Union. It has to, because what is the European Commission except a giant quango with enormous power, very little accountability, a very big budget, and Napoleonic ambitions? And, you know, when you think about it, the idea that most of our legislation has come from the EU in the last 20 years, most of it, all of it, has started with a proposal from the Commission, not the Parliament. Yeah. In other words, all European legislation starts from civil servants, not from politicians. That's quite shocking when you think about it. You know, we think of ourselves living in a democratic age, but I'm sorry, this is what Bonaparte and people like that had, and Louis XIV. This is not anything like what we would call democracy. I mean, back to the democratic deficit, but I do think that the claim that somehow Mr. Juncker is an expert on what Europe needs, in particular one field where, you know, the thing that motivates me to be pro-Brexit more than anything else is the European attitude to innovation, which is terrible. You know, we're trying to hamstring gene editing. We do everything we can to stop the growth of, you know, the digital industry in Europe. We're against, you know, chemicals and materials and all sorts of things. Sure, we hand out lots of money to universities to go and study innovation and do research, but only in such a way that we think is politically correct, not in a sort of let a thousand flowers bloom way and see what comes out. Europe has a real problem with innovation. It is way behind Asia and America now. And what is the European Union doing about that? Very little. That's, because Mr. Juncker is not an expert on innovation, but we've set up a system in which he's in charge.
Mm. Final question. Returning to the theme of optimism, how would you convince someone, maybe not a hardcore Ramona, because they might possibly be beyond convincing at this stage, but how would you convince the average person to be optimistic about Brexit and the opportunities that it gives us?
I think I would mainly talk about the future. You know, 95% of economic growth is coming from outside the EU. Britain has always been an outward-facing nation. We are a country of the world. The world, if you're worried about standards and things like that, the world is going to set them, not the continent. Raise your eyes to the world is what I would say. I think that argument cut through to some extent, and I think it's even more important now.
Matt Ridley, thank you very much.
Brendan, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.